Chapter 23. Minutes work, and then came a sixpence. This did moderately well for a time. In fact, I was not avaricious, but my dog was. I allowed him a third of the profit, but he was advised to insist upon half. This I couldn't stand, so we quarreled and parted. I next tried my hand at the organ grinding for a while, and may say that I made out pretty well. It is a plain, straightforward business, and requires no particular abilities. You can get a music mill for a mere song, and to put it in order, you have but to open the works, and give them three or four smart raps with a hammer. It improves the tone of the thing, for business purposes, more than you can imagine. This done, you have only to stroll along, with the mill on your back, until you see tan bark in the street, and a knocker wrapped up in buckskin. Then you stop and grind, looking as if you meant to stop, and grind till doomsday. Presently a window opens, and somebody pitches you a sixpence, with a request to hush up and go on, etc. I am aware that some grinders have actually afforded to go on for this sum. But for my part, I found the necessary outlay of capital too great to permit of my going on under a shilling. At this occupation I did a good deal, but, somehow, I was not quite satisfied, and so finally abandoned it. The truth is, I labored under the disadvantage of having no monkey, and American streets are so muddy, and a democratic rabble is so obtrusive, and so full of damnation mischievous little boys. I was now out of employment for some months, but at length succeeded, by dint of great interest, in procuring a situation in the sham post. The duties, here, are simple, and not altogether unprofitable. For example, very early in the morning I had to make up my packet of sham letters. Upon the inside of each of these I had to scrawl a few lines on any subject which occurred to me as sufficiently mysterious, signing all the epistles Tom Dobson, or Bobby Tompkins, or anything in that way. Having folded and sealed all, and stamped them with sham postmarks New Orleans, Bengal, Botany Bay, or any other place a great way off, I set out, forthwith, upon my daily route, as if in a very great hurry. I always called at the big houses to deliver the letters, and receive the postage. Nobody hesitates at paying for a letter, especially for a double one. People are such fools, and it was no trouble to get round a corner before there was time to open the epistles. The worst of this profession was that I had to walk so much and so fast, and so frequently to vary my route. Besides, I had serious scruples of conscience. I can't bear to hear innocent individuals abused, and the way the whole town took to cursing Tom Dobson and Bobby Tompkins was really awful to hear. I washed my hands of the matter in disgust. My eighth and last speculation has been in the cat-growing way. I have found that a most pleasant and lucrative business, and, really, no trouble at all. The country, it is well known, has become infested with cats, so much so of late, that a petition for relief, most numerously and respectably signed, was brought before the legislature at its late memorable session. The assembly, at this epoch, was unusually well informed, and, having passed many other wise and wholesome enactments, it crowned all with the Cat Act. In its original form, this law offered a premium for cat heads, 4 pence apiece, but the Senate succeeded in amending the main clause, so as to substitute the word ales for eats. This amendment was so obviously proper, that the House concurred in it nem. con. As soon as the governor had signed the bill, I invested my whole estate in the purchase of Toms and Tabbies. At first I could only afford to feed them upon mice, which are cheap, but they fulfilled the scriptural injunction at so marvelous a rate, that I at length considered it my best policy to be liberal, and so indulged them in oysters and turtle. Their tails, at a legislative price, now bring me in a good income, for I have discovered a way, in which, by means of Macassar oil, I can force 3 crops in a year. It delights me to find, too, that the animals soon get accustomed to the thing, and would rather have the appendages cut off than otherwise. I consider myself, therefore, a made man, and am bargaining for a country seat on the Hudson. Tilde 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 end of text tilde 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 equals 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 the landscape garden, the garden like a lady fair was cut, that lay as if she slumbered in delight, unto the open skies her eyes did shut. The azure fields of heaven were assembled right in a large round set with floors of light. The flowers the loose and the round sparks of dew, that hung upon their azure leaves, did show like twinkling stars that sparkle in the evening blue. Giles Fletcher, no more remarkable man ever lived than my friend, the young Ellison. He was remarkable in the entire and continuous profusion of good gifts ever lavished upon him by fortune. From his cradle to his grave, a gale of the blandest prosperity bore him along. Nor do I use the word prosperity in its mere worldly or external sense. I mean it as synonymous with happiness. The person of whom I speak seemed born for the purpose of foreshadowing the wild doctrines of Turgot, Price, Priestley, and Condorcet, of exemplifying, by individual instance, what has been deemed the mere chimera of the perfectionists. In the brief existence of Ellison, I fancy that I have seen refuted the dogma that in man's physical and spiritual nature lies some hidden principle, the antagonist of bliss. An intimate and anxious examination of his career has taught me to understand that, in general, from the violation of a few simple laws of humanity arises the wretchedness of mankind. That, as a species, we have in our possession the as yet unwrought elements of content, and that even now, in the present blindness and darkness of all idea on the great question of the social condition, it is not impossible that man, the individual, under certain unusual and highly fortuitous conditions, may be happy. With opinions such as these was my young friend fully imbued. And thus is it especially worthy of observation that the uninterrupted enjoyment which distinguished his life was in great part the result of preconcert. It is, indeed, evident that with less of the instinctive philosophy which, now and then, stands so well in the stead of experience, Mr. Ellison would have found himself precipitated, by the very extraordinary successes of his life, into the common vortex of unhappiness which yawns for those of preeminent endowments. But it is by no means my present object to pen an essay on happiness. The ideas of my friend may be summed up in a few words. He admitted but four unvarying laws, or rather elementary principles, of bliss. That which he considered chief was, strange to say, the simple and purely physical one of free exercise in the open air. The health, he said, attainable by other means than this is scarcely worth the name. He pointed to the tillers of the earth, the only people who, as a class, are proverbially more happy than others, and then he instanced the high ecstasies of the fox hunter. His second principle was the love of woman. His third was the contempt of ambition. His fourth was an object of unceasing pursuit. And he held that, other things being equal, the extent of happiness was proportioned to the spirituality of this object. I have said that Ellison was remarkable in the continuous profusion of good gifts lavished upon him by fortune. In personal grace and beauty he exceeded all men. His intellect was of that order to which the attainment of knowledge is less a labor than a necessity and an intuition. His family was one of the most illustrious of the empire. His bride was the loveliest and most devoted of women. His possessions had been always ample, but, upon the attainment of his 21st year, it was discovered that one of those extraordinary freaks of fate had been played in his behalf which startle the whole social world amid which they occur, and seldom fail radically to alter the entire moral constitution of those who are their objects. It appears that about 100 years prior to Mr. Ellison's attainment of his majority, there had died, in a remote province, one Mr. Sebright Ellison. This gentleman had amassed a princely fortune, and, having no very immediate connections, conceived the whim of suffering his wealth, to accumulate for a century after his decease, minutely and sagaciously directing the various modes of investment, he bequeathed the aggregate amount to the nearest of blood, bearing the name Ellison, who should be alive at the end of the 100 years. Many futile attempts had been made to set aside this singular bequest, their ex post facto character rendered them abortive. But the attention of a jealous government was aroused, and a decree finally obtained, forbidding all similar accumulations. This act did not prevent young Ellison, upon his 21st birthday, from entering into possession, as the heir of his ancestor, Sebright, of a fortune of $450 millions. *1. When it had become definitely known that such was the enormous wealth inherited, there were, of course, many speculations as to the mode of its disposal. The gigantic magnitude and the immediately available nature of the sum dazzled and bewildered all who thought upon the topic. The possessor of any appreciable amount of money might have been imagined to perform any one of a thousand things. With riches nearly surpassing those of any citizen, it would have been easy to suppose him engaging, to supreme excess in the fashionable extravagances of his time, or busying himself with political intrigues, or aiming at ministerial power, or purchasing increase of nobility, or devising gorgeous architectural piles, or collecting large specimens of vertu, or playing the munificent patron of letters and art, or endowing and bestowing his name upon extensive institutions of charity. But, for the inconceivable wealth in the actual possession of the young heir, these objects and all ordinary objects were felt to be inadequate. Recourse was had to figures, and figures but sufficed to confound. It was seen that even at 3%, the annual income of the inheritance amounted to no less than $13,500,000. Which was $1,125,000 per month, or $36,986 per day, or $1,541 per hour, or $6.20 for every minute that flew. Thus the usual track of supposition was thoroughly broken up. Men knew not what to imagine. There were some who even conceived that Mr. Ellison would divest himself forthwith of at least two-thirds of his fortune, as of utterly superfluous opulence, enriching whole troops of his relatives by division of his superabundance. I was not surprised, however, to perceive that he had long made up his mind upon a topic which had occasioned so much of discussion to his friends. Nor was I greatly astonished at the nature of his decision. In the widest and noblest sense, he was a poet. He comprehended, moreover, the true character, the august aims, the supreme majesty and dignity of the poetic sentiment. The proper gratification of the sentiment he instinctively felt to lie in the creation of novel forms of beauty. Some peculiarities, either in his early education, or in the nature of his intellect, had tinged with what is termed materialism the whole cast of his ethical speculations, and it was this bias, perhaps, which imperceptibly led him to perceive that the most advantageous, if not the sole legitimate field for the exercise of the poetic sentiment, was to be found in the creation of novel moods of purely physical loveliness. Thus it happened that he became neither musician nor poet, if we use this latter term in its everyday acceptation. Or it might have been that he became neither the one nor the other, in pursuance of an idea of his which I have already mentioned, the idea that in the contempt of ambition lay one of the essential principles of happiness on earth. Is it not, indeed, possible that while a high order of genius is necessarily ambitious, the highest is invariably above that which is termed ambition? And may it not thus happen that many far greater than Milton have contentedly remained youth and inglorious? I believe the world has never yet seen, and that, unless through some series of accidents goading the noblest order of mind into distasteful exertion, the world will never behold that full extent of triumphant execution in the richer productions of art, of which the human nature is absolutely capable. Mr. Ellison became neither musician nor poet, although no man lived more profoundly enamored both of music and the muse. Under other circumstances than those which invested him, it is not impossible that he would have become a painter. The field of sculpture, although in its nature rigidly poetical, was too limited in its extent and in its consequences to have occupied, at any time, much of his attention. And I have now mentioned all the provinces in which even the most liberal understanding of the poetic sentiment has declared this sentiment capable of expatiating. I mean the most liberal public, or recognized conception of the idea involved in the phrase etic sentiment. But Mr. Ellison imagined that the richest, and altogether the most natural and most suitable province, had been blindly neglected. No definition had spoken of the landscape gardener as of the poet, yet my friend could not fail to perceive that the creation of the landscape garden offered to the true muse the most magnificent of opportunities. Here was, indeed, the fairest field for the display of invention, or imagination, in the endless combining of forms of novel beauty, the elements which should enter into combination being, at all times, and by a vast superiority, the most glorious which the earth could afford. In the multiform of the tree, and in the multicolor of the flower, he recognized the most direct, and the most energetic efforts of nature at physical loveliness. And in the direction or concentration of this effort, or, still more properly, in its adaptation to the eyes which were to behold it upon earth, he perceived that he should be employing the best means laboring to the greatest advantage in the fulfillment of his destiny as poet. Its adaptation to the eyes which were to behold it upon earth. In his explanation of this phraseology, Mr. Ellison did much toward solving what has always seemed to me an enigma. I mean the fact which none but the ignorant dispute, that no such combinations of scenery exist in nature as the painter of genius has in his power to produce. No such paradises are to be found in reality as have glowed upon the canvas of Claude. In the most enchanting of natural landscapes, there will always be found a defect, or an excess, many excesses and defects. While the component parts may exceed, individually, the highest skill of the artist, the arrangement of the parts will always be susceptible of improvement. In short, no position can be attained from which an artistical eye, looking steadily, will not find matter of offense in what is technically termed the composition of a natural landscape. And yet how unintelligible is this? In all other matters we are justly instructed to regard nature as supreme. With her details we shrink from competition. Who shall presume to imitate the colors of the tulip, or to improve the proportions of the lily of the valley? The criticism which says, of sculpture or of portraiture, that a tour is to be exalted rather than imitated, is in error. No pictorial or sculptural combinations of points of human loveliness do more than approach the living and breathing human beauty as it gladdens our daily path. Byron, who often erred not in saying, I've seen more living beauty, ripe and real, than all the nonsense of their stone ideal. In landscape alone is the principle of the critic true, and, having felt its truth here, it is but the headlong spirit of generalization which has induced him to pronounce it true throughout all the domains of art. Having, I say, felt its truth here. For the feeling is no affectation or chimera. The mathematics afford no more absolute demonstrations than the sentiment of his art yields to the artist. He not only believes, but positively knows, that such and such apparently arbitrary arrangements of matter, or form, constitute, and alone constitute, the true beauty. Yet his reasons have not yet been matured into expression. It remains for a more profound analysis than the world has yet seen, fully to investigate and express them. Nevertheless, is he confirmed in his instinctive opinions, by the concurrence of all his compeers. Let a composition be defective, let an emendation be wrought in its mere arrangement of form, let this emendation be submitted to every artist in the world, By each will its necessity be admitted. And even far more than this, in remedy of the defective composition, each insulated member of the fraternity will suggest the identical emendation. I repeat that in landscape arrangements, or collocations alone, is the physical nature susceptible of zoltation, and that, therefore, her susceptibility of improvement at this one point was a mystery which, hitherto, I had been unable to solve. It was Mr. Ellison who first suggested the idea that what we regarded as improvement or exaltation of the natural beauty was really such as respected only the mortal or human point of view, that each alteration or disturbance of the primitive scenery might possibly affect a blemish in the picture, if we could suppose this picture viewed at large from some remote point in the heavens. It is easily understood, says Mr. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.